Duck South Studios in Oxford, Mississippi.
We're mass communicating.
It's a bold strategy, Cotton. Let's see if it pays off for them.
This is the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.
I gave it a 10.
Sweep the leg. You have a problem with that.
And now, here are your hosts, Rocky LaFleur.
Everybody on? Good.
Great. Grand. Wonderful.
No yelling on the bus.
Josh Webb.
Sorry I had a fight familiar, your black pants party.
And Jake Latondras.
I am bad news.
Also starring Rob Kroon.
I bet this guy's into the woods $100.
And Bradley Ramsey.
No, Mark, been saying.
Showtime.
All right, here we go. Hold your ears, folks. It's showtime.
Showtime, everybody! Showtime!
Welcome to the End of the Line podcast. I'm Rocky LaFleur, sitting at the Duck South Studios in Oxford, Mississippi. And on the line with me, Stephen Patrick, Mr. Pat Pitt. Guys, how are y'all?
Fine, y'all.
Doing great.
Oh, yeah, doing good.
Hey, are any of y'all making the trek east this weekend? Because I've heard that all Virginia and North Carolina residents will be given a free ticket to the Tennessee game this weekend. So I didn't know if you were maybe pulling out your baby blue or your navy blue, putting the hat on, trying to get a free ticket to go to the game.
Yeah. Oh. Well, I'd rather stay here. Well, our teal season opens in Arkansas, and I may have a line on some. I'm just waiting to hear back. But harvest is going so over there, and they're cutting up the fields quite a bit. The one farmer I talked to, so we're going to have some water, that's for sure. But we'll just have to wait and see.
Yeah, I can't see intentionally flooding a field for teal. I never have. I've hunted water that existed, you know, your low bodies of water during the fall, but I've never flooded intentionally and wasted food on killing blue-winged teal. Waste grain.
Yeah.
We had a field several years ago that I forget what hurricane it was that came up the Mississippi that may have been Katrina for all I know, but it dumped a bunch of water.
It wasn't Katrina.
It wasn't?
No, it's been since then. It wasn't Katrina.
Okay, well, Hurricane Elmo or whatever it was. It put a field just flat on the ground, the rice and the water. And if there was one teal, there were 10,000 in it. And it was ungodly. I mean, three of us were right out there. It took us longer to get out there in the Argo that Chris had than it did to shoot our limit of birds. But one of my farmers called and he said, hey, look, we're fixing to cut the levees on the top end of this field and all this water is going to come down and it will flood the lower end where the pit is. And it would save us quite a bit of money. We'll hold water, but I mean, we're not going to have all that water there by November middle of October, probably before all the birds get down. We may lose some grain, we may not. But I told him, yeah, go ahead and hold it because we got to the end of this month to hope to get some teal on it. And I talked to another guy not far from us, and he said several thousand teal on his place, so there's some around. So, but
will those reservoirs, will they that catch the runoff, those runoff reservoirs that they have in Arkansas, will they hold a lot of teal during the fall when they come through?
No. that 52 of Mickey's, I think I've still got the video when we stepped up over the edge of it right before the season opened, and I don't have any idea how many teal were on it. But yeah, they'll
it's
sit
weird
out there just like the big boys.
Sometimes they will and sometimes they won't because that's, you know, those things are typically deeper. There's typically no vegetation. So, you know, a lot of times A lot of times they won't, but sometimes they will. I mean, it's weird.
In Arkansas, let me ask y'all this. I hadn't been tied down to Mississippi for so long, guiding. Not a lot of traveling around Arkansas. Just in the last few years, I've hunted over there a good bit. But in its heyday, was catfish a big industry in Arkansas? It had to be because of the gumbo. You know, the clay, the really high clay.
You know, it's
a hard pan.
It never was. It never took off like it did in Mississippi. Now, there's fish ponds around, but they're not like they are in Mississippi.
See, in Mississippi, that's why Mississippi has a great population of teal, is a lot of these old fish ponds that's been converted in WRP now or into the sea. I think it's the C40, C30, something catfish CRP program, and people have water in those in the fall, and they will just be loaded, just little shallow water ponds. They'll be just loaded with teal.
You know, you got shallow water and vegetation, you got teal.
But it seems like this year, from talking to the people around the flyway, that Louisiana's not holding the number of birds that they normally do, but Texas is loaded already. And talking to people that really, really go after them, man, if you wanted to kill teal last year, you need to shift a little bit further west than us. You need to be in that central flyway. People are killing teal in New Mexico last year like crazy.
Well, birds will shift. I can remember when Arkansas didn't get any snow geese. You know, now look. You know, they mostly stayed, you know, in the central flyway, but that's changed. I mean, you know, weather patterns or whatever.
I'm sure, you know, available food, available water has a lot to do with it, of course.
Yeah. Well, Mike said the panhandle up there where he is pretty dry. I mean, they're waiting on hopefully get enough water. So the cranes are already starting down. So he's wanting to catch water. You know, I don't know. It's, you know, teal are such here today, gone tomorrow anyway.
Hey, Pat, before we jump off into your story, I want to ask you this historical question about waterfowl. Because I remember my grandfather and father talking about it years ago, the Canada geese. When did the Canada goose really start shifting the how far south it came? Because Canada geese used to come all the way, a lot of people don't know it, migratory Canada geese, big geese, came all the way into the Mississippi Delta.
I've got a video somewhere in Nash Buckingham shooting them down around Natchez on the sandbars. But, you know, that's the old...
This isn't your golf course geese. These geese were coming from up, I mean, from Canada, all the way making the trek down.
Yeah, we never killed a resident. Well, we didn't have any resident Canada geese. All the banded ones we got were from, you know, northern Manitoba, James Bay, I mean, way up. But, you know, farming practices changed, refuges. Ballard County, Kentucky used to have more Canada geese on it than God's got green apples. And, I don't know if you can find one on the refuge now, hardly. I mean, they used to have managed hunts up there for them on certain areas of the refuge, and they were literally by the thousands. Crab Orchard, Horseshoe Lake up there in Illinois, I don't know if they're getting the numbers of geese or not. They've learned to adapt.
I know I heard a good theory, and I think it's a lot too, is now the whole... all these power plants up north, they hold those warm water ponds where it ain't going to freeze up no matter how cold it gets, where those geese are always going to have open water. And if the snow ain't 10 feet deep for them, can't, you know, dry feed, they don't have to come south to those warm water you know, power ponds or, you know, the runoffs, you know, keeps rivers open, lakes open when it gets so cold. I mean, you know, there's no reason for them to come this far south.
Yep. You
know, why should they bother? But I mean, that's a good point, Stephen. I mean, it's as long as they don't have snow cover, and people talk about, you know, these fronts coming and cold fronts and all this business. If we don't get snow cover up there, covering up our food source, they're going to find a way to get to open water and to dry feed. Ducks are doing the same thing. They're learning bad habits from the geese and you know, your
that's
normal birds.
Do you think it's eerily similar, the Canada geese, and the way that happened, that boom, just a little bit more, just a little more, just a little more, as time went on, they started staying further and further north, and you're almost seeing it with the mallards, the big ducks.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, mallards, really. I mean, it's just like, why go to Florida to get a suntan if you can get one in Tennessee? You know, why fly all the way to the Mississippi Delta when you can stop in Illinois or Iowa or whatever and, you know, not have to go any further south? Saves money on gas.
Yeah, fuel. Fuel is everything to a bird in the science part of it. If you don't have to use it, don't use it. It's amazing the number of calories it takes a duck. And we as are just regular hunters don't understand what it takes for a duck to get down here.
Well, when it gets real cold, their metabolism just goes through the roof. And I've seen geese dry feed out in the Texas Panhandle where I'd have geese, I could dang near catch them, just all around me and a dog laying in a cornfield. I'd lay in there looking for a banded one before I shot one. They're just voracious, but they got to put those calories on because they burn so much.
You know, it was an amazing thing to me, Bill Cooks, he said to me about 2 months ago, and you may have been there, Pat, I can't remember if you were there or not. Or no, it was inside of the Duck South group that he said this. And I went back and looked at some research on this, and it seems to be the case. Bill said in a post that the stronger and the earlier we get cold fronts, the better the duck season is. If you get strong cold fronts in November, November all the way up to the end of November, the better the duck season is going to be in December and January overall, because they're just not going to go back all the way north to, you know, but they will stay there if they don't have strong enough cold fronts to push them out.
Right.
I agree. I can't remember how long ago it was, boys, when opening weekend we had ice, and I don't mean just skim ice. It was cold, and we stomped the mallards opening weekend. That's when a bunch of the dogs got that toxic.
That was 08.
'14. Do you remember the cold front we got in '14, November of '14? It was the second week of November. It was a cold front that came through. Man, it was in the low 20s all the way into Mississippi. It was the second week of November. It was rough.
Well, I think that's when we lost a lot of ducks that we were holding there. They pushed down below the freeze line, but they come right back. Our area, as soon as we get a little meltwater on the ice or between the ice and the levee, the birds will come back. They'll move right back up to the freeze line, I guess, so to speak. So, ducks are funny. We've spent hundreds of years trying to figure them out, and we're still coming up with new theories and new duck calls and new ways to kill them. And they're figuring out new ways to not get killed. So it's a pretty interesting game of ping pong, so to speak.
See, I think it's one of the coolest moments when, you know, the bird that you're calling to, when you're working a group of birds, you're calling to that lead bird. You're watching his body language. But when he gets over you, if he tilts his head ever so much and that one eye points down, and he's trying to figure it out.
You can see that's it. When, I mean, it's real important. The guys on each end of the pit where the dog boxes are, they generally keep up with the birds better than the ones, you know, in the middle. It, and the dogs, I depend on my dog a lot to tell me where the birds are, not necessarily how close they are, but, you know, the dogs are generally key on the birds. And I know when they get to the below us or above us or something like that, but you got to make decisions a lot quicker when you're hunting overcast and no wind. You can't get greedy. If you get one or two birds where you can kill them, you better take them. I mean, it's not sunshine, bright sunshine in a predominantly south wind, the way our pits are set up. You could probably stand out there in a red t-shirt with a railroad flare and still work birds in. We've seen it. But, you know, we tuck back up underneath our pit tops. We put our real grass on to where we got it hanging over the top of the pit tops. We use cattle panels, flip tops. And I tell the guys when we're putting them on, don't worry about, don't start at the bottom, start at the top. So we'll have this overhang so we can just sit back up in there and you know, you can watch them, you know, through the grass that's hanging down, and it makes it a hell of a lot simpler.
But, you know, I don't know which one of y'all said this a couple of weeks ago, but it's the moment that you fool a whole group of ducks. You talk about moments in duck hunting. You know, when you fool a whole group into 20 birds and bring them in, that's an accomplishment. When you fool wildlife, you make them do.
Yeah, you talk them into doing something they probably weren't going to do on their own without, you know, your coercion. It's
coaxing. That's right.
Yep.
Well, when I get excited on a flock of ducks, and you know everybody gets excited on a flock of ducks, but when I got those birds coming, you know, with the wind come and they get out there on a corner, and you yak 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 at the hen or the drake or whichever one's in the front, they just turn inside out to turn around to you. I mean, then you know you got them. I mean, you know, it's pretty much game over then. But that comes into when you call, not how you call.
No, Pat, I was sending your the hunting journal that went with your decoy today. I was mailing it, and I want it to be a little Pat Pitt, Dr. Andrew Nash Buckingham-esque. As I wrote in the front of that book that was going to travel around with your decoy, and I should have sent it to you and let you write in it, because, of course, just like recording these podcasts, a lot of times I have to go back and edit a lot of my crap out because it just sometimes it just doesn't make any sense. So anyway, in the front of it, I messed up the last sentence, and the last sentence was the most important to me. You know, enjoy the moments. Enjoy those moments that you fool them. That was one of the last lines I wrote. Now, I screwed it up, and that's not exactly what I wrote. I can't remember word for word what I wrote, but I had to scratch it out. I'm like, oh, my God, this is a traveling journal, and I had to scratch it out. This was supposed to be poetic, you know, as it travels around the United States. But, of course, I screw it up.
Well, maybe you set the precedent, so that takes the edge off of it. I wouldn't worry about it myself. I mean, you know, who hadn't screwed up duck hunting anyway? You know, I always say a little prayer when I'm working a flock of ducks. Oh Lord, don't let me screw up, because I want them all. But
Pat, you know, ducks weren't your first love, though. You know, when it came to animals. We're fixing to blow you away, because I know this little secret about Pat from Patrick and Steven, but ducks weren't his first animal, first love.
You asking me or the boys?
No, I'm gonna let you go ahead and tell everybody what it was.
Snakes.
And not hunting them. Not hunting them.
Yeah.
Well, hunting them to catch them.
Yeah. I get somebody on that's a friend of mine on Facebook. They post up a hero shot where they've stomped a rat snake or a garter snake or a rattlesnake to death. I unfriend them because it pisses me off. But I was so wanting to go into herpetology before I ever got hooked on ornithology. But, you know, if I wasn't up in the mountains fishing, I was up in the mountains looking for snakes. And we, back then, you could mail snakes in a mail. You know, we'd swap with people all over the country snakes. We'd order snakes from Indonesia, me and a couple of friends. We'd order them by the pound. You know, I forget what it was, but, you know, we'd order 50 pounds of snakes. We didn't know what was coming. You know, you get a big box, a big crate, and you open it up, and, you know, they're all in bags.
You hook up with somebody from Indonesia back then, is what I want
to know. They advertised in outdoor magazines, in the back of Outdoor Life, and magazines back when you could buy M1s for $79 and, you know, Browning A5s through the mail.
I'd like to see one of those ads. Buy some snakes. We'll send them to you in a box.
Good luck.
Well, you'd open the box, and some of the bags would have red cloth around them, so you knew it was something hot. Or one of the bags would stand up, and you could say, well, that one's a cobra. But, yeah, it was I was just head over heels about catching snakes. I probably had over 100 when I was in high school and college. Mom and Dad were pretty much petrified, and I had to, you know, be careful about. They didn't go in parts of the basement where I had a lot of them, but and of course I had some in my room too. When I was in college, had an apartment with a buddy of mine. I called Willard. I had a 7-foot Florida indigo that just had the run of the house. I mean, you'd come in, he'd liable to be laying up in the bookcase or under the couch, which was real exciting when you had a girl over for dinner and a drink or whatever. When he got hungry, he was a female. When she got hungry, she'd come crawling out, and I'd feed her raw chicken necks out of my hand. You know, and of course, that was before indigos were protected. They're protected now in their range, but it... I was just fascinated by him. I mean, Raymond Dittmars, and you may have never heard him, he was my hero. You know, he was one of the first well-known herpetologists. And you know, I just, you know, we sold snakes to zoos and swapped snakes with, you know, people in California that, you know, had rosy boas or California king snakes or whatever we happened to want. But it was... And probably Russell's vipers were my favorite of all of them, and that's the species that nearly killed Marlon Perkins. Marlon got bit by one, and he liked to die from it. I had three of them in a big 50-gallon aquarium, and you'd throw a hamster in there, and the snake would hit it. It wouldn't even get halfway across it before it did. I mean, they were super lethal, and the gaboons had fangs over an inch and a half long. They were, and just because they were a fat snake, but they were fast. Yeah, that's what I did. I enjoyed it. I still pick up a snake every time I run across one, and then turn it back loose.
Now, I'm like you. If I see somebody kill a king snake, garter snake, it drives me nuts.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, people that kill rat snakes, I hope they get bubonic plague or something. Because when I used to go to schools and do...
That's pretty strong.
Well, I'm pretty serious. But when I used to go to schools and do demos, and I work with I'd go with a Game and Fish, you know, one of my best contacts for duck hunting. When we go to schools, you know, we'd ask kids, you know, what is responsible for the most deaths in the world? And, you know, people were saying sharks and cobras and all this, or, you know, what animal? I said, no, it's a flea. I said, the Black Plague killed nearly 30 million, 50 million people, and it was transported by fleas off rats. And here's this rat snake, black rat, gray rat, yellow rat, whichever one, corn snake, that is exclusively a rat and mice eater. I mean, they were put on this earth for a purpose. My grandfather, if I ever caught a rat snake somewhere that wasn't in his barn, he wanted me to bring it to him. I mean, he'd turn them loose in his barn. You know, they may eat a few chicken eggs, but he wanted it in the barn for the mice and whatnot. Like I say, I was lucky. I never did do anything real stupid. And I mean, I've handled some stuff that, you know, most people would run screaming into the night. But I always handled a poison snake with my left hand. Because I figured if I was going to get nailed, since I was right-handed, I wanted that digit or hand or appendage compromised instead of my right one. So, and I was pretty much ambidextrous still. A chainsaw changed all that some years back. So, anyway, that's what I grew up doing, catching snakes.
Didn't you buy a collection from a widow of a guy that was killed?
Yeah, a woman in Florida. I think she was in Florida, maybe in California. But anyway, she had a spectacle cobra, which is the one with the two spots on the hood. And it bit him and killed him. And I don't know how we got connected with her. I think it was with the Jacksonville Zoo where we had sent some snakes. And she wanted the whole collection gone. So, you know, we drove down there. And we used to go to Florida a lot in the spring collecting snakes. But we drove down there and got everything he had. And, boy, he had some cool stuff. I mean, he had fertile lances and canteels, which is a tropical cottonmouth, and you know, just some really neat snakes as far as neat snakes go. You know, a lot of hot stuff. He was real big into the different rattlesnakes. And this was before all the designer boa constrictors and pythons came about with the piebald ones and the albino ones and all the ones that they've got now when you go to these reptile shows. But and we ended up giving that cobra. That cobra was so aggressive, you couldn't even get near the cage he was in without him just going ballistic. We ended up sending that cobra to Jacksonville Zoo. But yeah, he was about a 5-footer. He had an attitude. I can remember that. But I know Steven mentioned one story that was pretty funny once it was all over with. But, you know, we would have snakes come into the airport in Chattanooga Level Field, and we'd get a phone call, you know, from the terminal that baggage or freight had a box for us, you know, marked hold at airport. And, of course, we knew what it was. And, you know, we'd go out there and get it, and sometimes it'd be late at night, you know, when they came in, because Chattanooga's not a big, busy airport anyway. But, you know, get a phone call, and I go out there, and the snakes that we bought or traded for, we always wanted to, you know, make sure of live arrival, because, you know, most of the people that dealt with them were real good at, you know, if one was lost in transit, I mean dead lost, not getaway lost, they'd replace it. So one box was, you know, all nominal size stuff, you know, and pretty much, you know, I had my snake stick. I'd, you know, touch a bag, and if it moved, everything was fine. But one box was by itself, and we'd ordered a big anaconda, nearly 14, 16 feet. But there was a box by itself, and I figured, well, that's the one that the anaconda's in. So I asked the guy that was there, he was there by himself. He was a black man. I said, "You have a screwdriver?" And he said, "Yeah." He went and got it. I said, "I got to pry the top off this to make sure that this is live and whatnot." And so he's standing right there, dying there, shoulder to shoulder with me. And I pried that top off, and when I flipped the top off, that anaconda wasn't in a bag. It came out of that box like a Saturn missile, and I grabbed it. I grabbed it as it was going up. And of course it, you know, threw coils around my arm, around my leg and whatnot. And I don't know if you know about anaconda bites or not. You don't jerk your hand away from them, because their teeth are so big and curved. I mean, they will do surgically repaired potential damage to you. And, of course, he was just, you know, mouth open, big enough to shove a rabbit down. And so I'm standing there with him trying to get untangled, and I look around, and this guy's gone. I mean, I didn't even hear the door slam. He may have run through it. He was gone. And I guess I was hanging on to this thing for, it seemed like forever, but I know it was 10 or 15 minutes. And I see this head peek around the door, and it looked like two headlights coming out of a tunnel. His eyes were so wide. And I said, I need you to come here and help me get this thing back in the box, because I couldn't do it by myself, because I couldn't turn the head loose. I had it with both hands. And they'll wrap a coil around you, and then they'll try to pull their head back, you know, to slip it out of your grasp. And of course I was into that game. And he said, "No, sir, no, sir," and he turned around and left again. So another eternity went by, and he stuck his head back in. He said, "I got to close." I said, "Well, you got to come help me get this back in the box." And I told him, I said, "I'm not going to turn loose of it. I just need you to start unwrapping it off." It even had part of its tail in my belt loop. I mean, I was all tangled up with it. And so he comes in there, and the first time he touched it, I thought he was going to throw up. But he finally started helping me unwrap it. And I said, "Just start sticking it back down in this box. I'm going to hold the head." And I said, "Get that lid for this box and put it where you can get it. And as soon as we get everything in there, I'm going to dunk the head down in there, and we're going to put the lid on it." Well, we finally got it done, and finally carried it out. But I will never forget the look on that guy's face when that snake came out of that box. And I mean, he didn't come out slowly either. I mean, it looked like he was catapulted out of it. And I was just lucky enough to grab him a couple of inches behind his head, where he couldn't turn and get me. But I never did get bit by one of the big snakes, but a friend of mine did, and he's probably still got scars from it. But yeah, they were entertaining, never a dull minute.
Did you ever get bit?
Well, I got bit by a pygmy rattler one time. I never got bit in the wild catching one, but pygmy rattler was in a 20-gallon aquarium. It was about an 18-inch pygmy, and they're not big, but they got a pretty good wallop, you know, when they dose you. But there was a couple of other things in there. There was a little baby fertile ants and a bamboo viper that was up on a little tree limb, and I was watching it because he was real, you know, real quick and real aggressive. And this pygmy nailed me in the little finger. And of course, it scared the crap out of me. I'd been out partying the night before, and I wasn't real clear-headed, but I got clear-headed real quick when that happened. And my first reaction was, what am I going to do now? Well, I stood there a few minutes, and there was blood in both fang holes. And I said, well, he got his fangs in me. But he gave me a dry bite, which snakes a lot of times give people. You get a dry bite from them, even if it is poisonous. But I didn't get any sensations or tingling or discoloration and whatnot, so I just put the top back on it and went about my business. But, you know, it's not, I don't think there was any Russell's Viper antivenom within 1,000 miles of where we were with some of this stuff we had, you know. Well, but it was, you know, it was fun while it lasted.
I don't know where to go from snakes, because this is one that my wife will not listen to.
Well, she's a veterinarian. What if somebody comes in with a red-tailed boa or a ball python sheep?
She'll send them right out the front door.
Will she? send them out running like you were when you were hawking Texas rigs?
Yeah. I figured you would enjoy that.
I did. It looked like, at first I thought it was an Our Gang comedy with Porky running by or something. And that was entertaining. That's what I like to see, stuff like that. You know, everybody needs to laugh. We've had a lot of funny happenings, duck hunting and everything else. So, a little levity is good for you. Keeps you from being so serious all the time.
It amazes me, though, the things that catch on in the duck hunting world, like the term running. What duck call are you running? What motor? Nobody really says motor. What e-collar are you running?
Yeah, I mean, what flat brim, piece of work came up with that? I'll let them have whatever, things they want to say.
Come on, I know you want to let it out.
You'd have to do a lot of editing.
Yeah, you're edit meter. But I think it is a silly thing. It just, like these barrel stickers. And by the way, I've got a barrel sticker on my Benelli now. It says Chiquita Bananas. We were goose hunting, and a friend of mine was eating a banana, and it had the Chiquita sticker on it, so I stuck it on my barrel, so I'd be cool like everybody else and have a barrel sticker.
Bo sent Steven and I a picture the other day. It is by far the stupidest one I've ever seen. You see them all the time, meat stick and whatever. I can't even remember all the dumb slogans that I've seen. But this guy, he was laying in his layout blind and had his gun propped in his lap like you do. And his barrel sticker said, "Meat in the freezer."
Good grief. Well, Steven, you need to tell your story about hunting with meat stick.
No.
Hey, Steven, before you jump into that story, let me ask you something. And you may not be able to really talk about this, but when you're sitting in these corporate meetings where you're talking about marketing for duck hunting or hunting in general, man, it just amazes me the stuff that's out there in the hunting world that has nothing to do with hunting, but utilize it for marketing and hunting. Do you just ever sit back in that boardroom and go, "Oh my God"?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that comes across that I just shake my head at, and just, but then again, I shake my head at, I can't believe it. We just sold a whole bunch of them. It kind of goes both ways. We've seen products that we didn't think would catch on that did, or vice versa. So, I mean, it shocks you how stuff can work out like that. But I mean, my dad said, it's, you stuff make something in camo, someone's going to buy it. So his answer, you make rubber dog shit and camouflage it, somebody's going to buy it. So,
only if it's mossy oak bottom land or duck land.
I need to get y'all into a message with Josh Webb. Josh Webb sends me pictures all the time. I'm not a huge Instagram guy, but it seems that's the world where this wild marketing of this younger generation lives.
Definitely.
He sent me this picture the other night of this girl in a bikini bow hunting. I can't remember what the hashtag was for that.
I'm pretty sure I know where Josh got that from, because there's a page out there that just it's just a page nothing but just ripping all these social media celebrity, so-called celebrities or wannabe celebrities, and it's just it's hysterical. I mean, because it just pulls up everybody that does stuff like that bow hunts and while wearing a bikini and stuff like that. So it's Instagram is I think where a lot of it is kind of heading towards.
here's my thing. Look, there's a lot of good women that hunt.
Sure there are. But what I just say, I'm on pins and needles.
The things that go on Instagram of they're called huntresses.
Mm-hmm.
It just amazes me.
Yeah. Because it's. I mean, some of them give them a bad name. I mean, I really do. I think they're just deserves for the following. But the huntress's tag is just, man, it's a, I don't know how I can say it, but it's just not used correctly, put like that. You know, I think it's more of an Instagram model instead of a huntress. You know what I'm saying?
It's a look at me. It's look at me, not I can hunt.
But there's tons of companies that are paying these ladies.
Oh yeah, because
to market
they know
their
that,
products.
Yeah, because they know they can get them in a bikini and get 100,000 followers a lot quicker than I could. You know, I don't have the personality as they do, and the
plastic.
And the scenery, but they definitely use them as free marketing, that's for sure. So that's what it's all about, is that how many more followers they can get and how many more products they can pimp for them. So, and all it costs them is a couple of T-shirts and some hats. So,
well, there's bikini bow fishermen, too. I've seen it, and I know a guy down in Florida, and actually a friend of mine's hunted with them. Fished with them. They fish Okeechobee, and you know, you go to his page, and it's his wife. You know, bow fishing or reeling in bass and whatnot, and I mean, doesn't leave a whole lot to imagination. So, but it sells. I mean, ain't no doubt about it. You know, it's just.
Now I know one of your first loves, Mr. Pat, is the flat bill hat. I mean, it's amazing.
Oh, yeah.
That amazes me that part of our pop culture has leaked into the duck hunting world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It drives me insane. I cannot stand a flat bill hat. And the only thing that makes a flat bill hat worse is if you tuck your ears inside the hat when you wear it.
Yeah.
Never see that.
You are a moron if you wear your hat that way.
That's right. To me, it looked like you ought to be standing on the street corner with an organ and a monkey wearing a flat bill hat. I mean, it just, you know, you might as well go the whole 10, you know, nine yards with it. But, you know, getting back to barrel sticker, meat stick, the first time I saw that on a shotgun was at our club. A member's son had it on his gun. And Steven got to take him hunting one morning. Or one afternoon. When was
that? Was an afternoon.
Yeah. Okay. So, but I remember him. It was a Browning pump. And he took it apart one night and couldn't get it back together. And he was about to cry. And I was the only one still up watching television and whatnot. And I put it back together for him. I don't know if you've ever taken a Browning pump apart, but they are tricky to get back together. First time I ever saw it done, we were in Alaska, and there was two of the guys had them, and they both had them apart, and it was like 2 o'clock in the morning before we got them back together, because the slides on them, I mean, the stops, magazine stops, come out, and it's hard to get them back in and get the trigger back in, but, you know, and that's another thing, people need to know how guns work, you know, not just put a shell in and pull the trigger, they need to know how to troubleshoot guns.
A Browning BPS is one of the hardest pump shotguns to put back together.
Yeah, they're not an 870.
Don't ever knock that front pin out. You can knock the back pin out and take the trigger out. But, when, you know, those slides, I mean, the magazine stops, you know, on both sides, they'll come out as soon as you pull that trigger out. Or at least they would in the older models of them. I don't know if they do now or not. I used to have a pump, Browning 10-gauge pump. And the only thing I didn't like about it is you couldn't reload it quick enough because you couldn't drop a shell in the chamber. You know, you had to stick it in the magazine and then rack it in. But, you know,
I'll tell you this. When I was guiding one time, a guy was getting ready to leave, and I had to drive him back to the airport. And I went in there to hand him his bill to get settled up, and before we left to go back to the airport. I walked in there, and the guy owed me $1,800.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, handing the bill, he pulled out this wad of cash. You'd think he was a drug dealer, but it turned out, as he counted it off, 1, 2, 3, 400, it turned out to be $670-something. So he was $1,200 short of paying me, $1,100. He said, what you want me to do? I can mail you a check when I get back home. Well, the odds of this Yankee mailing me a check back, after coming and shooting limits for 3 days, Yankees were just different. People ask me,
Tell me, you'll probably get a lot of people that will quit subscribing to this podcast, but I've had more problems dealing with people from the North than I have with people from the South. I don't know if it's your mentality or expectations or pronunciation for that matter, but I agree with you.
I told him, he said, well, what do you want to do? I said, well, you don't leave you and your son's gun here. I'm going to just take him as payment until you get me a check.
Well, collateral.
He had a Browning Gold and a Browning DPS that his son was shooting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, he never called me back. So I ended up with I don't want to sound like I'm complaining that I ended up with, you know, $2,000 worth of guns for $1,100 bill. But anyway, that DPS, man, first time I took it apart to clean it, oh my God, it was a nightmare.
Make you cry. I know where you're coming from on that. But
he called me, look, the crazy thing about it is, he called me like 3 years later. I guess it's the first time he had ever gone duck hunting again. 3 years later, he called me and said, hey, you care if I send you that $700 and get my guns back? I'm like, nope. The guns are mine.
I've had people show up to hunt with guns new in the box, never been put together. Didn't know how they went together. You know, you're there 30 minutes before shooting time getting shotguns put together for them. So, and hoping they don't say, well, where's the safety?
Some of the worst feelings in the world as a guide or in your position, y'all's position, is having guests in. Is somebody that walks in with a bunch of tags hanging off of new stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's the worst feeling. You knew that you were in, you were about to give the speech. I always called it the speech before the hunt.
Mm-hmm.
When you talk about, you know, your zones that you're shooting in, where you keep the gun, you know, the drill sergeant speech.
Well, Patrick posted up a picture on somebody's thread on Duck South of a guy that swung a gun barrel. And did you shoot the gun, Patrick, or did somebody else?
Yeah. No, it was me.
Okay. Patrick was on an end, I guess, since he had a dog. A guy swung hard left or hard right, and, you know, when Patrick pulled the trigger, his gun barrel was right there, and it ruined it. And it's lucky somebody didn't get hurt. But
wow. That is very, very easy to do in those pit blinds, to swing over somebody and blow their eardrums out.
Yeah, it happens inadvertently a lot of times, but you have some people, you got five people in a blind, a guy on the far end is, you know, trying to kill a teal that's landing, you know, in the dog box on your end, basically. You know, people, I guess they get excited and whatnot, don't think. But boy, the last thing I want is somebody shot or a dog shot or, you know, somebody hurt.
We generally have my ears ringing.
Well, yeah, that too. We generally ask people to show an empty chamber when they're coming out of the pit when we're, you know, getting out. And, for the most part, we do it. Or, you know, we'll put a shell in sideways in the magazine in the chamber where you got the shell sticking out and people can see it.
You know, and I always say that's the most important thing in pictures. I see people posting pictures all the time, and I'm the same way with the shell. I'll put a shell, if it's automatic, you know, I'll leave one with the brass into the action, or if it's a pump, I'll have the lever down, the pump down. And mm-hmm. I see pictures all the time, man, of a gun leaned against the tailgate of a truck, and you can't tell them the dog's sitting there and the gun's pointing right at the dog.
Or the guy's head.
Yeah.
So, we've been very fortunate, and like I say, you don't have to guess what I'm thinking when, you know, it comes to gun safety. And the boys are the same way. I've seen them when they were a lot younger than they are now, call down grown men my age that weren't practicing what we preach. So, but they got it drilled into them by me, because I told them, you know, you can't take a bullet back.
So, no.
There's no way around it. So, but anyway.
I have really enjoyed it. We have ran out of time. Another great episode. I know that we got some exciting. We're going to turn a little comedic, is the word, for next week.
Yeah.
Got a couple of funny stories we're going to turn in next week. Should be really
comedy,
good.
Comedy relief is coming. Stay tuned.
Well, guys, thank y'all again for being here. We want to thank all of you that listened to this edition of the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.
Ladies and gentlemen.